Hello, everybody, and welcome to Peace Wanakism on the Voluntary Virtues Network every Thursday at 1 p.m. And you could also find me on theconsciousresistance.com and theseedsofliberty.com. So today we have, or I'm delighted and very excited to have Lawrence Reed, who is the president of FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education. He's a libertarian voluntarist, and he's on Facebook as Lawrence Reed. And you could also find him on Twitter at Lawrence WR. And you can see all of his work, follow his posts there. And so Lawrence has traveled, among other things. You can check out his Wikipedia page. It's pretty extensive. He's traveled to 81 countries now. Held hostage in 1986?
Oh, I would say detained might be a better word.
Detained in Poland for a few years. So that was a fun time, I'm sure.
Yeah, it sure was. I didn't know if they were going to let me out or not, but they did.
Wow, I'm so grateful that they did. I'm sure a lot of people are. So he's written a bunch of books. His recent one is called "Excuse Me, Professor: Challenging the Myths of Progressivism." And he basically takes on head on the a bunch of myths that most statists would hurl at you, and he just debunks them in the most beautiful way. So we're going to talk about that among other subjects. Upton Sinclair, The Jungle, which is supposedly an indictment of capitalism, and we'll talk about that. And we'll get into the Great Depression as well as the robber barons. You hear all the time how if it wasn't for government, monopolies would destroy, the world. We'd all be working 16-hour days, no bathroom breaks, no vacations. Our toddlers would be in the factories with us.
That's right.
So, Lawrence, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you, Danilo. I've been looking forward to this. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I've really heard a lot about you. And I was delighted when I saw Luis Mises interview you on his Emancipated Human, and I'm like, wow, that is awesome. I gotta get this guy on. I've heard a lot about you.
We had a lot of fun that night, I recall.
Yeah, beautiful. So maybe can you get into a little background before we get started as to how did you get involved in libertarianism? I know you have a pretty extensive history, but just give us a little background how you got involved in the liberty movement and then in FEE.
Okay. A lot of people in the liberty movement started out as socialists or interventionists of one kind or another and then moved in our direction. But that's not the case with me. I was always rather libertarian-leaning, at least anti-authoritarian. And I first became active as a teenager in 1968 after the Soviets invaded Czechoslovakia. I was quite upset about what they were doing and wanted to reach out and do something to help the Czechs. And that proved to be joining a demonstration against the Soviet invasion in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It was sponsored by Young Americans for Freedom. And I joined that group at that time. And that was my pipeline to free market literature, libertarian literature. And it changed my life and put me on a path to advancing liberty in every way that I know how, as a teacher in the classroom, and now as foundation president.
Awesome, yeah, and so eventually you became president, but I'm sure you've been active in writing articles, writing books, right, and giving speeches,
yes,
and things like that. So so please get into your book. I really want to talk about these myths that we hear all the time from people. Please.
Well, it seems like half the time, those of us who believe in free markets, we're talking about the misconceptions about freedom and free markets, the mistaken beliefs that people have. And so I decided, since I'd written a lot about some of these things, to put those essays in one place, write a few new ones. And so the result is a book called Excuse Me, Professor, subtitled Challenging the Myths of Progressivism. It's got 52 chapters, and every one deals head-on with one of these misconceptions, such as capitalism caused the Great Depression, or Upton Sinclair's The Jungle proved that we needed government regulation. 52 in all, and I could probably write four or five more books with 52 more in each of those.
Wow.
They just keep on coming.
Yeah, there's no end to the logical fallacies.
Sadly, that's right.
You know, like I, you know, the Great Depression, you know, the intervention, and also like government intervention, you know, got us out of the war, and or yep. that the war was actually beneficial, actually, because I heard right that Tom Woods is going to start a weekly podcast with Bob Murphy about you know debunking Paul Krugman, right? Every week he makes a column.
Oh yeah, Bob and Tom will have endless material for that.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing how when I talk to people and they talk about they just, you know, mindlessly regurgitate this stuff, and I'm like, wait a minute, if you're saying that war is good, basically what you're saying is murder is good. Murder helps the economy.
Yeah.
Right.
And of course, and you and I know that war simply diverts resources away from the things that you and I as consumers would prefer to have. Like automobiles and refrigerators, and instead makes tanks and guns and planes. And arguably, those things are needed to win a legitimate war. But don't confuse that with the idea that somehow is an economic stimulus, because it isn't. It's a diversion of resources. It's a destruction mm-hmm. of resources. And we'd be better off without wars.
Right. Yeah, I tell people that... you know, the government, it can't create wealth, right? I liken it to like a tick. You know, saying the government creates wealth is like saying a tick can create blood. You know, it's a parasite, right? It siphons off productivity from the industrious, from the people who actually create value without guns, without force, without, you know, coercion. And then they get, you know, something attached to them called a bureaucrat and just sucks off, you know, right?
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. It's absolutely right. The most that government can do is redistribute wealth and charge you a fortune to do it. And even then, the end result is not something that is conducive to either health or happiness.
Right. Please, can you get into Upton Sinclair, The Jungle, and what you wrote about that?
Sure. Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, which appeared a little over 100 years ago now, is taken as gospel in a lot of places. I know that in public school classes, I recall teachers sort of presenting it as if it was fact, that these conditions in the meatpacking plants of Chicago that Sinclair wrote about were awful, that there were people falling into the vats and being ground up into meat products and sold to the public. And, you know, not too long ago when I started researching this, one thing I wanted to find out was, okay, who were these people who fell into the vats and were ground up into meat? Surely we could find some names. Mm. Surely there were family members or coworkers who said, hey, what happened to Bob? You know, why didn't Matt come home from work today? You know, but there were no such people. That's why you won't find any monuments to them anywhere, because it never happened. And that was true of much of Sinclair's book. He didn't write it with the idea that this is going to be some kind of a documentary about conditions in the meatpacking plants. He knew almost nothing about the meatpacking plants. This was a novel. It was a work of fiction. And its purpose was to advance a socialist agenda, which he freely admitted. So he cooked up these charges. Even Teddy Roosevelt, the president, said that the man was a notorious liar. And then today, though, it's presented as if, he exposed these terrible conditions, and it led then to the Meat Inspection Act of 1906. We had to have government regulation because the private meatpackers were poisoning their customers, which is ridiculous, absurd on its face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. It's you would think if some people died in your factory, like it would make headlines somewhere, you know, and you would see, you would see a trail, a paper trail, right?
Yeah, or the family would complain, you know, right. I want to know what happened to Dad, but it never happened.
Dad didn't come home, eh? We'll find a new dad.
I guess we'll just have him for supper tomorrow.
Right. It's a real easy way. Like, same thing with the child labor laws. You know, people think that without government regulation, we would still have, you know, toddlers working in factories, right?
And that's another myth that we address in the book, too. Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's funny. I remember Tom Woods made an interesting argument, saying how, you know, a lot of the factories in India, I guess because of their poverty, a lot of the children have to work in the factories, right? Because what is the alternative? Starvation or prostitution, right? So I mean, maybe to our lifestyle, there that working condition is you know, obscene, or you know, it's not preferable, but what is their alternative? And when you and when you outlaw what they're doing, then you force them into a lesser alternative.
Absolutely. Either the children have to go underground and work in even worse conditions, or the family is condemned to a life of extreme poverty if they're able to survive in places like that. You have to go back to pre-industrial days and ask yourself, well, did children work before that? Or were they just dancing around the maypole in the middle of the Middle Ages? And then capitalism came along and put them to work in the mines or the factories. Well, no. Children were lucky pre-industrial revolution to live to the age of five. Even Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, as late as 1776, points out that the average Scottish woman had 17 children and was lucky if five of them survived to the age of five. So if they were lucky to survive, they worked. It was capitalism that allowed for the greater productivity gains of their parents that ultimately took them out of the mines and the factories, not socialism or interventionist legislation. It was capitalism that made things so productive that parents in time could work, be productive enough to earn enough that the children didn't have to work.
Right, right. And, you know, when I'm talking about these topics with people, it's helpful to, for me, I find, to go back to the basics. You know, they talk about capitalism and they talk about, you know, socialism, and they talk about fascism, but they don't really know, like, hold on. How do you define capitalism that you hate so much? You know, and they point to Wall Street. That's capitalism.
Yeah. They think people making money, that's all it is. And if they think some are making money in a nefarious way through their political connections, they don't differentiate that from real capitalism, which is honest people creating wealth for consumers and not using their political connections to get any special advantage at the expense of others.
Yeah. And I think it's so difficult for people to see that, because we live in a society that's so intertwined and intermingled with status regulations and laws and taxation, that it just distorts the the free flow of resources, of capital, you know. And so it's really difficult to imagine what would a you can look at the black market, right? Even that wouldn't exist without the state, so that's really a creation of the state, right?
Yeah, a lot of people have this reflexive reaction. They see a problem and it doesn't occur to them to ask, you know, might there have been some previous government intervention that, that contributed to the problem? Yeah. They just start with a problem and say it must be the fault of free markets, and so more government is the answer, even if it was the problem in the first place.
Right. It's like they start with the ground. Yeah, right. Yeah, so I tell them, you know, what is the definition of capitalism? I go to Merriam-Webster Dictionary, and I think it says it's like the private ownership of factories and means of production in private individuals, right? No mention of government whatsoever, and that's it. I would add to that, my definition would be, peaceful people engaging in voluntary interaction. That's it.
That's right. Yeah. No special favors, privileges, immunities, subsidies from government at all.
Right. Yeah. And then you ask the person, are you against that? Peaceful people engaging in voluntary. How can you be against that? You know?
And exactly.
You support involuntary interactions or theft or assault or, you know, anything that's a win-lose scenario.
That's right. The initiation of force in some way.
Right. Exactly. So can you go into a little bit of the myth about the Great Depression and how, you know, thank God for FDR and his New Deal. He just lifted us. He like a savior. You know, thank God for his pen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he just did it with a wave of his wand or his pen. I'm delighted that you raised this, because it's one of my favorite topics. The general misconception is that free markets failed us in 1929, and that Herbert Hoover, the president then, was a stand-pat, laissez-faire, do-nothing president, and that Franklin Roosevelt had to come in and intervene in the economy to spur recovery. All of that is total bunk. You have to look back and ask yourself, well, what preceded the stock market collapse and the coming of the Depression before 1929? Well, you had the Federal Reserve System, which is a government creation created by the Congress that had inflated the money supply, drove interest rates to record lows for 5 years in a row from 1924 to 1929. It spawned this artificial boom, the Roaring Twenties, we call it. It was easy money stuff, interest rates at historic lows. There was a land boom in Florida. It sounds a lot like just a few years ago before the big bust of 2008. So you had the Federal Reserve stoking the fires with easy money, but then the Fed, the Federal Reserve, changed policy around the end of 1928 into early 29 and started raising interest rates, choking off the growth in the money supply. They first had expanded money and credit over that previous 5 years by like 65%, and now from 29 until 1933, they contracted the money supply by about a third. So the economy went through this cycle because that's what monetary policy was doing. But nonetheless, that explains the start of the Great Depression, but not why it was so deep and lasted so long. That was because of other interventions that were undertaken starting in 1930. In the spring of 1930, after the stock market crash the previous October, you didn't have a depression yet. You just had a recession. You had unemployment only at 8.5%. And a stock market that had crashed but had regained half of the ground that it had lost. What took us from a recession in 1930 and to a Great Depression quickly was an act of Congress, the Smoot-Hawley tariff that raised tariffs, taxes on imported goods, to an all-time high and almost closed the borders. And foreign countries retaliated. They raised their tariffs on American goods. And so you had governments piling on and taking a recession and making it a depression. And then in 1932, Herbert Hoover, still president, he doubles the income tax in the midst of a depression. He doubles the income tax. The top rate was raised from 24 to 65% in an effort to try to boost federal revenue at the expense of the depressed economy. That only made things worse. And then finally, when Roosevelt came in 1933, he prolonged the depression by about 7 years because of ridiculous interventions one after the other. We can talk about those if you'd like. Okay. Well, in 1933, he became president, Franklin Roosevelt, and he started the New Deal. And two of the most destructive aspects of the New Deal were the National Industrial Recovery Act, which imposed price controls, codes, regulations on businesses that raised the cost of doing business by about 40% on average. There was even a famous case of a man named Jack Magid. He was a tailor, and he was prosecuted under the NIRA because he pressed a suit of clothes for 35 cents instead of the required price of 40 cents. Now get this, you're in the midst of a depression. You're lucky if you got a suit of clothes, you know, to be pressed. Here's a guy who says, I'll do it for you for 35 cents, and the government goes after him because he didn't charge you more, 40 cents. This was the government trying to raise prices by decree, right, which was ridiculous. And then in agriculture, it did even worse. They passed the Agricultural Adjustment Act, and that put a new tax on agricultural processors. Now, keep in mind, farming is in terrible shape by 1933. Mm-hmm. Agriculture is in awful depression, one of the hardest hit sectors of the economy. When Smoot-Hawley, that tariff I told you about, was passed, it destroyed a big chunk of overseas markets for American farmers. So they're in terrible shape. So Roosevelt says, well, let's destroy supply. And let's put a new tax on agriculture, and we'll use the money to pay for the destruction of perfectly good fields of corn, wheat, and cotton, and the slaughter of perfectly good cattle, sheep, and pigs, and then keeping them off the market. Secretary of Agriculture Henry Wallace, in a single order, ordered the destruction of 6 million baby pigs under this stupid legislation. Well, the Supreme Court saved us from that because for about a year and a half, those two laws and other stupid interventions were making things worse until the Supreme Court declared them unconstitutional in 1935 and 36. So then we start to see some recovery in the economy, 1937 comes along and we get another collapse, a depression within a depression. Mm-hmm. And that's because in that year, fresh from re-election, Roosevelt starts jacking up taxes. He came into office, you know, in 1932, attacking Hoover for raising income taxes. But now that he's president, he's going to raise them to all-time highs. He took the top rate from Hoover, which was 73%, made it 91%, just the opposite of what he said he would do. So he's raising taxes. They passed the Wagner Act in 1935, scheduled to take effect in 37, which gave enormous powers to organize labor. And armed with those powers, organized labor went on a strike spree in 1937, closing factories across the country, sit-down strikes in the auto plants. The number of man-hours lost to strikes in 1 year's time, 37 to 38, doubled from 14 million man-hours to about 30 million, thanks to that stupid act of Roosevelt and the Congress. So we kind of limp along through the 30s, still in depression, and it's not until World War II comes along that at least the unemployment rate falls. And so some people mistakenly think, it was the war then that saved us. Well, not really. The standard of living did not improve during the war years. What did improve was the unemployment rate, because we drafted 11 million men, sent them to Europe and Asia, and didn't count them any longer in the unemployment statistics. We didn't really get improvement in the general economy until after the war. And when government spending came down and tax rates start to come down, the corporate income tax rate under Harry Truman, the year the war ended, fell from a high of 90% to 38%. So you get recovery when we start backing off, when government backs off the economy, but not we didn't until it backed off.
Wow. There's a lot I can say with that. Yeah, I remember reading about FDR, how, like, at first, when I started getting into voluntarism and you know, learning about free markets, I really thought that Obama was a pretty, interventionist president with all of his executive orders. And the last time I checked, I'm not sure, it's probably like 180 or something or 200 executive orders he's done.
Yeah.
But, and then it came to my attention that FDR, like, he pales in comparison to FDR, right? I think FDR, yeah, he averaged like one executive order every other day.
Yeah, even the seizure of your gold coins
was done.
Executive order. It was in April of 1933. Right. He said you had less than a month. Roosevelt said every American has to turn in, this is by executive order, not by act of Congress, you have to turn in to the government your gold coin, your bullion, under penalty of 10 years in prison or $10,000 fine, right, just by presidential decree.
Yeah. Yeah, and you guess he's not a dictator, right?
Yeah, that's right.
yeah, and actually another thing I'd like to point out to people is, the alcohol prohibition, you know, times, so people were, it was illegal, right, for, yeah, I guess, distilling and purchasing of alcohol, and gold was legal, right? But then yeah, I think, was it, so 1933, So that year, I guess, or the following year, it was illegal, right? And legal,
right,
for gold. And then the following year, it was completely switched to legal.
Yeah,
alcohol,
yeah.
Illegal for gold.
Yeah, if you had two guys walking down the street in 1933, one of them with a gold coin in his pocket and the other one with a bottle of booze in his hand, the one with the booze was the crook.
Right.
And the guy with the gold was an honest man. A year later, it was just the opposite.
Right.
You have to give Roosevelt credit for one thing. He did push to end prohibition, but sometimes I think that was because he probably stopped and realized that all this garbage he was imposing on the economy meant that the American people needed a good drink. And so he pushed for abolition of prohibition.
Yeah, yeah. I mean that, and then the Federal Reserve, that's another great topic I like to get into with people, because nobody knows what the Federal Reserve is at all. Like, they just, I don't even think they even look at their dollar bills when they use it. Like, I'm like, do you even know that the Federal Reserve is actually written on the dollar?
Yeah.
And people are surprised at that. And then I go further. Do you know what the Federal Reserve is? No.
Yeah. No. Few people do.
And so that's one of the major, like when I talk to people about, precious metals and free markets, I usually start with talking about the monetary system and how precious metals, were once a part of our currency, and why is it not a part of our currency anymore? And that's a good story, kind of a backdoor entry into, libertarian thought and, free markets, because, when you start outright attacking government, a lot of people get defensive and emotional, right? And they retaliate. But when you start talking about the monetary system, not many people have an opinion on gold and silver.
Yeah. I can't think of another agency of the federal government that has more disastrously failed the promises made for it. It's only been around 100 years, but we were told when it was founded or thereafter that it would iron out the business cycle. It would guarantee the security and stability of the dollar, that it would provide just the right amount of money. Well, here we are 100 years later, and under the Federal Reserve, we've had the greatest of our depressions, which even the previous head of the Fed, Mr. Bernanke, publicly said, we caused it. It was our mistakes. We've had a Great Depression, about 10 recessions, each of which was brought on by their easy money followed by tight money, and a dollar that's worth a nickel of what it was when they were started. Now, to me, that screams failure, but nobody seems interested in getting rid of it except we libertarians and voluntarists.
I can talk a lot about gold and silver. I've really researched that. That's a fascinating topic to me. What is the difference between a forced currency and a voluntary currency? All fiat monies are all forced, right? Legal tender by law, arbitrary decree. And then you have the arbitrary currencies like shells and beads and, copper and cigarettes and lumber and all these things were used as currency but abandoned for whatever reason, but they're all used voluntarily because people tried them and just, and then eventually the market discovered gold and silver, and for, at least 3,000-4,000 years, there has not been a more superb currency.
That's right. But, if government is going to grow like it has in America, if it's going to go down the welfare state path, it's going to make war on sound money, because sound money means that they can't spend more than what they take in. It basically reduces to this. The governments of the world don't like gold because they can't print it.
Right. Yeah. One thing I like to tell people is how much do you think it takes to print, store and transport a $1 bill, right? And I remember reading it's approximately 6 cents, right?
Yeah.
And then how much do you think it takes to print, store, and transport a $100 bill?
Yeah.
About 7 cents, because the extra zeros require a little bit more ink. Right?
So that's the only difference.
And then they look at me in shock, like, what? That's all it's worth? Yeah, it's just paper and ink. That's it. How easy is it to make that? Just printing press, or even now, they just digitally, do it. But how about gold and silver? How do you create gold and silver? Okay, we mine it, but how is it created, right? So two ways that I know of is the collision of two neutron stars and a supernova.
That's right.
So
I don't think the Fed does it that way.
Yeah, so you can imagine that the government wouldn't like gold and silver because they can't control those things.
Exactly. And it's never been an exception to this. Every welfare state sooner or later abandons sound money because politicians want to spend more than they've got and manufacture money to help accommodate their spendthrift ways and their incredible debt that they pile up to pay for the stuff.
Right. I mean, it's like, once a country or a government hijacks the money supply, it's downhill from there. And that's where the true control is. We can talk about laws and regulations, but once they control the money supply, that's like the lifeblood of an economy.
Yeah.
And they have complete control from then on. They can print at will and bail out and give favors and subsidize
Well, Danilo, I can tell that you like to use good analogies to help educate people. The one I often use when it comes to money is I just try to get people to realize how absurd it would be if somebody said, well, let's have 7 people appointed by the president put in charge of regulating the supply of take your pick of the commodities. Say green beans. Okay, we're going to have a green bean board, and these seven guys are going to decide how many green beans there ought to be. Well, we laugh at that. We say, how would they know? But the market knows. Right. And so the market's in charge, and you never have to worry about there being a shortage or a surplus of green beans. Money's the same. Mm-hmm. How does seven people appointed by the president to constituting the Board of Governors of the Fed, how do they possibly know what the proper supply of money should be? We ought to be frightened at the very thought that seven people think they know such things. They don't know. They don't know what the supply of green beans ought to be, let alone money for an economy of 320 million people.
Right, right. And one interesting thing I remember reading in What Has Government Done to Our Money, right, Murray Rothbard, mm-hmm. is it doesn't matter, because everyone's always saying, like you know, you look on these Fox and CBS and NBC, and they say, you know, if we just reach 1%, 2% inflation, you know, we're good.
Yeah.
as if inflation is normal. As if it's just an everyday fact of life, right?
Yeah.
But when you have to realize, wait a minute, what is inflation? Define it. That's the other thing I tell. Define inflation. They say rising prices. No. That's the effect. The cause is increasing the money supply. And so therefore, as a result, it steals value from savers, from people who have the currency. So it's theft. They're stealing their value without actually physically stealing your money. They're stealing the purchasing power.
You're absolutely right. So when Janet Yellen at the Fed says that they have a target for inflation, they want to get it up to about 2%. Another way of saying that is she wants to destroy your savings at the rate of 2% a year. She wants to erode the value of your medium of exchange and of your wages by 2% a year. Why is that virtuous?
Right. And so, yeah, this is what I was going to say is, you know, it doesn't matter really, fundamentally, it doesn't matter how many units of any currency is in the society, because regardless, it doesn't matter let's say it's stationary, it doesn't increase and the population increases, so that means everyone's value of their currency increases, you know, in proportion to that. And so, I remember Mike Maloney from goldsilver.com, he was saying that, if we could have just one gold coin, right, in a vault, all these cameras on it, you know, guards guarding it, one gold coin, and we could theoretically put a serial number on each atom of the gold coin,
and that's all you need,
and that would be a wonderful, you know, impossible to be counterfeited, finite supply.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. This is an enduring lesson of monetary economics that people don't understand. Once the market has selected a commodity to serve as money, gold, silver, it's utterly irrelevant what the quantity is. A relatively small quantity of the money substance simply means that prices or that goods will trade at relatively low prices. A relatively large quantity of the stuff simply means that goods will trade at relatively high prices. So as long as prices are free to reflect whatever the supply and demand of goods may be on the one hand and that of money on the other, it will adjust to a price level, so to speak, that reflects those conditions.
Right, right. And another interesting thing I noticed is, you know, in movies, popular movies, you know, Hollywood movies, if you see a movie that like features a bank heist, mm-hmm. most of the time what they're stealing is paper.
Yeah.
Right? Federal Reserve.
It would be good if they went out and had a bonfire, because all the other money that you and I have in our pockets would suddenly be worth a little bit more.
Right. and what's funny about that is, I mean, very, very rarely you would see a heist movie that actually features people stealing gold bars. Very
That's
rare,
right?
Most of the time. So that to me, that reflects the societal understanding that paper is money. Right?
Yeah.
Notes are money, not anything hard or, you know, hard currency or something that cannot be counterfeited, but something that can be printed at will by a government agency. That's money. That's what we should revere. That's what's on the cover of magazines. That's what everybody's lusting after. And it's
yeah, people are really mixed up when it comes to money. I like to point out, too, that under a gold standard, that doesn't necessarily mean that the only thing that circulates in our pockets as money are bits of metal. Mm. People may prefer paper, but there's a connection between that paper and the real money substance. You can redeem or convert the paper into gold or silver on demand. That's what we used to have. But oftentimes people, if they know the paper is as good as gold, they'll use the paper. But you abandon the gold, and sooner or later people will flee from unbacked paper.
Yeah, I one of the eye-opening and lightning books that I read when I first started researching all this stuff is Creature from Jekyll Island.
Right? Oh, yeah. Eustace Mullins. That's right. Yeah, no, you're right.
Yeah, G. Edward Griffin. Yeah. And he, oh, my God. I remember when I was reading that, I would call my family members like, do you know that there's four types of money or four evolutions of money? You know, first you have commodity, then receipt, then fractional, then paper, I guess, right?
Yeah,
fiat. Yeah, right, fiat. And I'm like, wow, I didn't think about it like that. It's an evolution, right? and just like you said, but then the only thing the other thing I would say is even if in a voluntary society, let's say a stateless society, they still choose to use the paper, it's not the same as fiat because the fiat is forced by decree, and the paper backed by gold is voluntarily used by the people.
That's right. Well, you mean your government schools didn't teach you that? They didn't give you both sides even?
Right. I talking about government schools, I remember learning in my economics class two things, right? Two things that really stayed with me. The first one was he said Alan Greenspan is the most powerful man in the world. Mm-hmm. And I did not know who Alan Greenspan was at that time. Even years after that, I still didn't know until I started studying, Austrian economics, and I realized, wow,
yeah, you didn't get to vote for him,
right? The unelected, that's amazing. And the other thing he talked about supply and demand, and he had a great analogy. He's, because it was seventh period, so it was the last period of the day. And so it's after lunchtime, right? And he asked, did anybody not have lunch, right? One kid raised his hand, and he said, okay, over there is a box of donuts. Eat as many as you can. and then 15 minutes later, he asked the kid, all right, the first donut, how good was it? Scale of 1 to 10. And he's like, oh, it was awesome. It was a 9. And then, of course, as the donuts went, he was like, oh, the second one, oh, not as good.
we call that the law of diminishing marginal utility.
Right.
And it applies to money as it does to anything else.
Excellent. I mean, it was a great analogy. It stuck with me all these years. So economics, that's another great topic I'd like to talk to people about because, it's not emotionally charged. Like when you talk about immigration, that's emotionally charged. We talk about, the war on terror, emotionally charged. You talk about, any of these kinds of things, minimum wage, emotionally charged, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, when you talk about basic economics, like that's just human action. That's what people are incentivized to do. How can you hate that or argue it? Right?
Well, one of the crucial differences between a free market or capitalism and socialism is that capitalism, free markets, is what happens when you leave people alone.
Right.
They find ways to specialize, they trade, they exchange, they invest, they build enterprises. Socialism, which has no theory of wealth creation whatever, it's only a theory of wealth redistribution, that's a contrivance. It has to be cooked up by somebody in usually academia. Somebody who's not well grounded in reality and is insulated, isolated, probably tenured, and is cooking up plans for other people that they want to impose upon them by force.
Right.
That's totally different than a free market, which is what happens when you simply respect life and property and leave productive, peaceful people alone.
Right. I remember I saw a John Stossel video on the how Soviet Union was and how strictly they try to micromanage each industry. Like how many shoes should each person have and how many shoes should the factory make and what size should they make?
Oh, I mean, entire books and volumes have been written by socialists, trying to explain here's how you should do it. But it's laughably preposterous to think that a handful of commissars would know such thing. One of my favorite quotes from Hayek, the Nobel Prize winner, Austrian economist, is that the curious task of economics is to convince men is to convince men of how impossible it is to Oh, shoot. Isn't that awful?
No, I know which one you're talking about, of what they can imagine, something like that.
Yeah, how difficult it is to do what they imagine they can design, something like that. That's close, yeah.
Right.
In other words, he was saying, quit making out like you're some kind of a god and you know such things. The market will guide us, but not a handful of politically appointed, short-sighted commissars.
Right. Yeah, so you know, when I tell people that, you know, we have to trust in the market. Right? To me, I can imagine other people looking at that saying that, you know what, that sounds exactly like what I'm saying. I'm saying Obama can solve everything. I'm saying the government can solve everything. You're just saying the market can solve everything. So what's the difference? Right, we're all putting our faith in just like a god.
The difference is the same difference between the Girl Scouts selling cookies, and you getting to choose whether you want to buy them or not.
Right.
And Al Capone shooting up the streets of Chicago and making sure you buy booze from him. I mean, that's the difference. It's the initiation of force. Government is force, legalized force. Markets are peaceful, voluntary, mutually beneficial interaction.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. The difference is, when I say the market, yeah, to me, I can see how some people would say, you know, that's just a, you know, an entity. It's non-corporeal. It just doesn't exist. It's all out in the ether. Well, what is the market exactly? It's just individuals trading. That's it.
Yeah.
So basically, yeah, when we say the market, we say we don't know everything. We don't have all the answers, but just let people trade and they can, you know, pursue their own self-interests, and yeah, and in a strange and magnificent way, that will actually increase the wealth and increase the standard of living for everybody.
Yeah, and while at the same time, centrally planned systems where you've got commissars in charge and they're told, or they tell others what to do, they're all flops. Meantime, the miracle of the market is happening before our very eyes every moment of every day. No mastermind, right. No top-down mandates, no emperor decreeing things. Right. It just happens because you and I engage in trade and commerce and activities peacefully with other people.
And the other funny thing is when people like really attack capitalism and free markets and, you know, say, you know, warlords would take over, monopolies would run rampant. It's funny because it was really the free enterprise and people creating and increasing the standard of living and creating so much wealth in society that we have the leisure to criticize capitalism.
Yeah, that's
because,
right.
Because otherwise, we're not working in 16-hour days.
In pre-capitalist feudal times, yeah, we were burning the candle at both ends and had no time to deal with such silliness. We had to work practically 24/7 because that's what the lord of the manor told us to do.
Right.
And we barely eked out an existence for centuries.
Right. And the other thing that's very important to point out to people is that at every stage in history, that is the best time to live. Right? Right? It's always the best time to live. So, but we look back in history and like, you know, those people were savages, they were barbarian. How could they live that way? You know? And I think the people in like 100 years from now, they're going to look back at us and say, you know what? Those people, they had to actually type.
Yeah.
They had to talk. How could they live that way?
That's right. And I hope that in 100 years, people will look back and say, can you believe those people in 2015 still allowed their government to assign their kids to the school they had to attend by their zip code? Can you believe that? Can you believe that government actually confiscated people's gold and silver, gave them worthless paper in exchange, and called it progress? I mean, we'll laugh at some of this stuff that we've endured in our lifetimes.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I saw a great cartoon of these aliens. They just visited the Earth, and then one alien saying to the other, they're just robbing from each other, and they're calling it like the economy or taxes, but it's just they're just robbing from each other. What's wrong with them? but please, before we go, can you get into a little bit about the robber barons and, you know, the whole myth,
sure,
about, you know, if it wasn't for the Teddy Roosevelt breaking up the money trust and the steel trust, we would be living in poverty and
absolutely. There are two or three chapters in the book that deal with this. By the way, Excuse Me, Professor book. So I would urge readers to look that up. One chapter deals with John D. Rockefeller, who's the number one boogeyman, in statist history, the way statists look back at our history. They say John D. Rockefeller made a fortune in oil and that was evil. But, he cut the price of kerosene, which was his principal product, from about 40 cents a gallon to 3 cents a gallon. He didn't restrict output. He massively increased output, sold all over the world, improved the quality of the product, brought down the price to a fraction of what it was. But, he made a lot of money off of that, but he made a lot of other people a lot better off. And today, so many people just write that off. I think there's a lot of envy when it comes to looking back on the so-called robber barons. They don't like the fact that men became rich because they serve customers. Oh, no, they did it because of their greed.
Right.
I sometimes wonder why we allow the left to get away with these bumper stickers. They can spout off a myth in about 10 seconds, and we have to respond with all the details, all the homework that they didn't do.
With an entire essay.
Exactly, yeah. But there's so many fallacies involved in the antitrust laws. The very first one simply said it was a crime to monopolize an industry, but it didn't define what that is. What about a company that does a job so well it gets 80% of the market? And let's suppose it has a new invention that if it puts on the market, it'll suddenly please consumers so widely that they might sell 90% of the market. Do you want them to hold back and not do that to benefit consumers because they might, quote, monopolize the market? Sometimes I hardly know where to begin with these robber baron myths, but I certainly urge people to give the book a look and they'll see some responses. Another good book on the subject is a classic written 30 years ago by Burton Folsom, F-O-L-S-O-M, entitled The Myth of the Robber Barons. And it is a wonderful, entertaining read, and it goes through industry after industry, mostly in the late 19th century, and shows that so many charges against them are just quicksand. They're not the mythology, bumper stickers, but they're powerful nonetheless.
Yeah. Like, when I talk to my mother, we'll wrap up quick. When I talk to my mother about these things, because she's a diehard socialist, and she brings this up a lot about the robber barons and monopolists and all that, and she's like, how could you support these? They're destroying their competitors. I'm like, well, I mean, if they're really serving the customer, right, and the people are buying it voluntarily because they have a superior product, I think they should deserve that success. Like that's the prize for investing and for creating a business that is not easy to create, right?
Yeah,
creating a successful business, putting their money on the line, putting their neck on the line. I think that's a worthy prize, and I don't. Yeah, I don't hold anything against them. Hopefully they didn't use any government, subsidies or favoritism any loopholes, things like that. But but then again, I guess today the big corporations today, I guess we consider the crony corporations, have massively utilized those subsidies and tax breaks and things like that to raise the barrier to entry for smaller businesses impossible to compete with them and things like that. So,
well, ask your mother. Would she be happier with an economy where we didn't let anybody win in the competitive battle with anybody else? What if we conducted horse races that way, or say Olympic Games? If we said, "Oh, we can't let anybody win because that means somebody has to lose," but the fact is, in a dynamic economy that's ever changing because consumers' preferences are changing, you're going to have industries replacing industries. If we had said to the old buggy industry that, we can't let any of you guys go out of business, and yet this automobile thing is going to throw you out of work. Right, so let's prevent the automobiles from coming along. Right. We might have saved a few buggy jobs, but we would have prevented a lot more automobile jobs and higher standards of living as well.
Right. Oh, yeah. I bring that example up a lot. You know, what if the government decided to subsidize the horse and buggy industry at the expense of the automobile industry, just like they did the big banks, right? Where would we be? And that's the, you know, that's diverting resources to the most inefficient and poor use of or poor management of those resources, and that, you know, people will suffer in general.
Just pick up a 1910 Sears catalog. You can still get them on eBay. And look at the things that were being sold in 1910, most of which were made by companies that no longer exist. They were replaced by new products, new companies, new technologies. They all went out of business, and it's a different world today than it was back in those times. And that's good for all of us.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Well, I don't want to keep you any longer. Lawrence, thank you very much. I really appreciate the conversation. So please, can you give the readers some links and how they can contact you or follow your work?
Absolutely. First of all, the website of my organization, the Foundation for Economic Education, is easy to remember. It's fee.org, fee.org. There, if you want to reach me, you'll find my email address, but it's also lreed, L-R-E-E-D, at fee.org. So check our website out. Drop me a note if I can be of any help.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Really appreciate the conversation. I've heard a lot about you. I'm delighted I'm able to get the chance to speak with you.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you, Danilo. Appreciate it.
Yeah, so this is so if anybody wants to donate to my show, help us out. You can donate Bitcoin, PayPal, or Patreon. We have the links below. Help us out. This is a labor of love. I love doing it. And, you know, it's always nice to have some monetary support.
I'd like to second that recommendation and urge your supporters to do that, because I know these things cost money.
Yeah, yeah, money. And you know, my wife, she's always saying, what are you doing? This is not making us money. Why do you keep doing that? Well, you know.
It's the cause.
Right. You know, I mean, it's like, for me, it's like a snapshot in history, you know, and I'm recording my thoughts. And yeah, you're just putting your voice out there. You know, I think the more people put their voice, you know, either through writing, through video, through podcasting, you know, the more voices for liberty, the more we can criticize or you know, put, you know, these wretched and inefficient government laws and regulations on the stand and expose them, right, to the sunlight of logic and reason, the more I think, you know, we will contribute to greater wealth and increased standard of living.
So, very well said. And these ideas are critically important. You're a hero for advancing them. And to your viewers, I want to say, send this guy a check.
Or, thank you very much.
Or Bitcoin.
I appreciate that. So thanks, everyone, for listening. This is Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network. And you can also find me on theconsciousresistance.com and theseedsofliberty.com. Wishing everyone have a wonderful day. Take care. Bye.